These are the patterns of invisible waves we use today for communications. Radio waves, television waves, microwaves. In the same family, a vast potential for tomorrow are visible waves, the waves which man calls light. In other centuries, they would have called it magic.
Hi, I'm Alexis Patrick.
And I'm Lisa Berry Drago. This is Distillations, coming to you from the Science History Institute.
And today, we are talking about the disputed origin story of a very important invention.
Day by day, scientists have under development a new device which could revolutionize man's use of light. It is called a laser.
That's from a video called The Conquest of Light, produced by AT&T in 1962.
And the story of the laser has everything.
There's an underdog inventor and a star university scientist who both claim the invention as their own.
There's betrayal, twists, turns,
communism,
high science, low science,
masers, lasers, optical pumping,
and a frantic trip to the candy store, as you do.
Invent anything important or exciting, obviously you have to have a lot of building blocks in your head to do it. So if I say the idea for the laser popped into my head, yes, it popped into my head, but only after my head had been working away on all the materials for all those years.
Our story begins in New York on November 13, 1957, with our protagonist, outsider scientist, inventor, and physics graduate student Gordon Gould. We just played a clip of an interview with him from 1984. Gould died in 2005, but we found these oral history interviews from the 80s. Just a heads up, the quality is not the best, and you might hear the interviewers laugh from time to time. So, anyway. After working intensely for a week, Gould takes a laboratory notebook full of sketches, equations, calculations, and the statement, written on or before November 13, 1957, to a candy store in the Bronx. When he gets there, he asks the owner, who also happens to be a notary public, to stamp each of the 9 pages he's filled out. They're so squeezed full of drawings and symbols and equations that the notary public can only find room for a stamp in the margins.
In the heading of the notebook, Gould has written this title, "Some Rough Calculations on the Feasibility of a Laser, Light Amplification by Stimulated Emission of Radiation."
This trip to the candy store proves pivotal because Gordon Gould would spend the next 3 decades trying to convince the world that he had invented the laser.
That's our own Rigoberto Hernandez. He's been nerding out about this story for weeks.
Even though Gould was the first person to figure out how to make a laser and he coined the term, no one knew it because he waited a long time to share his notebook with anyone else. And in the meantime, 2 other physicists figured out how to make a laser too. And they got a patent for it.
In the subsequent years and decades, people won Nobel Prizes and built entire industries around the laser. And Gordon Gould was left in the dust. No one believed he came up with it first.
Because Gordon Gould didn't have a PhD. He hadn't won any fancy scientific awards. He didn't publish in any scientific journals. Oh, and he dabbled in communism.
It took 30 years, many courtroom battles, millions of dollars, and an epic fight with the U.S. government and the laser industry before Gould could get any recognition for one of the most revolutionary inventions of the 20th century.
In the process, he got rich. His case helped change U.S. patent law forever. But 60 years later, the central question in the story is still debated. Did Gordon Gould invent the laser?
This actually is a very tricky question to answer.
So, Lisa, I think we should pause for a minute and talk about the word invent.
Ooh, good call. Merriam-Webster defines it as to produce something, such as a useful device or process, for the first time through the use of the imagination or of ingenious thinking or experiment.
Right, but in terms of U.S. patent law, that doesn't mean anything. You don't actually have to build the thing, it just has to be buildable. Okay, cleared that up. Proceed.
I can honestly say that it was my mother that stimulated me to get interested in inventing things and making things. Certainly not my father, who couldn't handle a screwdriver. He was a magazine editor.
That's Gordon Gould in 1984. He studied physics in college and then went to Yale to get a PhD in optics and spectroscopy. But he was there during the height of World War II, and he was drafted. A professor told him to apply for a project other scientists were working on to keep him out of combat.
Lo and behold, it turned out later to be the Manhattan Project, and I worked there for the rest of the war.
Two significant things happened to Gould there. First, he gets a girlfriend who turns him on to communism. He starts going to Marxist study groups in Greenwich Village with her.
Not long after that, the couple gets fired from the Manhattan Project. Gould thinks it's because he had protested anti-Semitic hiring practices.
But it probably also had something to do with his communist ties. His politics would continue to cause him trouble down the road.
So he goes to a company to make mirrors, but his coworkers tease him and they call him college boy, but he makes the perfect mirrors. In his spare time, he continues to invent. His hero is Thomas Edison.
But he was an inventor as distinguished from a scientist. He didn't pursue that scientific discovery. I never was interested in studying something just for its own sake. There had to be an important application at the end of the road for me to really get excited.
Gould uses his knowledge of optics to come up with his first invention, an improved contact lens. He's really excited about it. He sets up a meeting with a contact lens manufacturer in New York. But once he's in the office, things don't go so well.
I didn't want to tell him what the invention was. So that's not a very good way of selling yourself and the invention. And they were interested, but I was so naive. It wasn't possible for us to come to terms.
So Gould was just very suspicious.
Nick Taylor is the author of Laser, The Inventor, the Nobel Laureate, and the 30-Year Patent War. He thinks Gould's untrusting nature was his Achilles heel.
He wanted, again, that Edisonian ability to convert his invention into a revenue stream. And he couldn't bring himself to reveal everything he knew, because he was too suspicious.
Despite not being able to sell his ideas, he keeps plugging away at his inventions to varying degrees of success.
In 1948, Gould becomes convinced that he can grow diamonds.
Wait, what?
I'm sorry, come again?
So Gould thinks that if he puts a small diamond and then gets a chunk of graphite and then heats it up inside a vacuum chamber, that he can make the diamond bigger.
I'm sorry, does this work?
No. So his brother, who is a chemist, then tells him that the thermodynamics are not sound. And so then he decides that if he wants to continue being an inventor, he needs to take more physics.
So in 1949, Gould goes to college for the third time, this time to Columbia to try again to get a PhD in physics. He's very pragmatic, though. Remember, Gould's not a science for science sake kind of guy. He wants more knowledge to invent better things. He picks the program mainly because it's an easy commute to his teaching job.
But he was in this hotbed of scientific inquiry with great, great minds at the Columbia Physics Department was at the time.
There are past and future Nobel laureates on staff, but one in particular stands out, a distinguished young professor named Charles Townes. Our story's anti-hero. Or is he our hero? It's hard to tell.
The way that I see these two characters, Townes and Gould, is that Townes is almost aristocratic sounding because of his standing with the academic community. He is a Nobel laureate. And here you have Gould, who is even labeled a communist, which back in the day might as well be the worst thing you could have been called.
Right.
It's like foils of each other.
Well, they're exactly right. Charles Townes was extremely prestigious.
He was a Southern gentleman. He was just a very nice person. At the same time, he was very dedicated and single-minded in what he did.
Like that 2015 NPR clip suggests, people really liked this guy. They called him brilliant. He was a 34-year-old physics star who had achieved great things and was expected to achieve lots more. Gould and Townes were on different paths professionally, politically, and personally. Townes was invested in the esteem of academia.
He was involved in all these boards, these advisory groups.
Gould just wanted to learn more physics so he can invent something useful.
He didn't pursue the same things. He didn't pursue the prestige of being named to boards and being named to advisory groups. And he was raffish. He did have this communist history. He liked a martini and enjoyed the company of women. He went sailing. His sailing buddies said that he was usually the last person on the deck with a drink in his hand when everybody was went to sleep when they were at anchor. And so he's a completely different personality. But I do know, having followed Gould's patent war, that Gould was every bit as accomplished a physicist as Townes. Townes just couldn't believe it, because Gould was not an academic physicist. He didn't play by the same rules.
Maybe we're all conditioned to think that it would make perfect sense for someone like Charles Townes to have invented the laser. He had the title, the pedigree, the awards.
And that was the assumption that Gordon Gould would spend 30 years fighting. Gould was just 5 years younger than Townes, but he was just a graduate student. But their offices were close together, and they did know each other, and Townes is quick to point this out during a 1987 interview.
I knew Gordon Gould quite well. He'd been a student just next door to me, two offices over.
The proximity of the two men's offices is important to note. This was a physics department where people were sharing thoughts and collaborating on cutting-edge ideas.
The idea for the laser didn't come to Gordon Gould out of thin air. It was actually building upon something that Charles Townes had already built, called the MASER, which stands for Microwave Amplification by Stimulated Emission of Radiation.
Wait, so when we say Gordon Gould came up with the word laser, he literally just changed one letter from Townes' MASER?
It seems that way, yeah.
Yeah, when you say it like that, I was a little disappointed to say, oh, he just changed one letter in the beginning to say that it's an invention. But actually, to go from a maser to a laser is very complicated.
Sure.
Maybe you should tell us a little bit more about the maser. What does it do?
So the maser actually proved one of Einstein's theories on stimulated emission. And I'm oversimplifying this, but stimulated emission is basically energizing atoms so they'll emit light, but not visible light. In this case, in the microwave region of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Now, the problem with the maser was that it emitted its radiation all over the place. You know, beam here, beam there. And so it was not a coherent beam of light.
Man has long since generated light for vision. But this ordinary light by which we see is wayward, undisciplined, a jumble of waves of different sizes and colors radiating outwards in wild disorder. How can light, in nature undisciplined, be harnessed for communications, which needs a constant coherent flow of light in only one direction?
Gould started thinking along these lines. Townes started thinking along these lines. All over the place, people were thinking of, you know, how do we do this?
Okay, so scientists already know how to amplify microwaves. Now they're thinking about how to amplify visible light waves. And they're especially thinking about it at Columbia. Even though Townes isn't Gould's professor, they do talk about this how to turn a maser into a laser problem.
So in 1956, they talk about optical pumping.
Ooh, okay, so this is where the optical pumping comes in.
Yeah, this is a technique that gets the molecules inside the box excited using optics. So before we were talking about microwaves, now we're on to visible light. Remember Gould's background in optics, the contact lens? Well, he suggested Townes that optical pumping could be incorporated into the maser to excite atoms and essentially get in one step closer to as of yet to be named or invented laser.
It's clear that both men are now trying to solve the entire laser puzzle. For Gould, the race is on.
Then, one night in November 1957, Gould has a realization.
He wakes up in the middle of the night and he has this flash of intuition. And so he gets up, he's a smoker, he puts on a pot of coffee, lights a cigarette, and he sits down and starts to write. And in the very first page of the notebook that he starts to write, he says, some thoughts about a laser, light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. This is the first use of the word laser. So he created the term. And then beneath that, he draws a diagram. And what he draws is the essential way a laser, the early lasers, worked.
Inside this laser, equipped with special mirrors, atoms are excited with an external light source. When they are weakly excited, the atoms begin to give off light independently of one another. However, when they are strongly excited, conditions are created which force the atoms to release light all to the same beam. The beam gets brighter as it moves within the laser. In a fraction of a second, it builds up millions of times and bursts through one of the mirrors. A beam of light more intense and more precisely directed than has ever been produced in man's history.
When Gould's finished, he goes to the candy store / notary public and has his work signed and stamped. And he takes home a carton of cigarettes, for good measure.
So meanwhile, Charles Townes and his brother-in-law, Arthur Shallow, who is a physicist, are also inching closer towards figuring out how to make a laser.
By now, it's the spring of 1958. Gould has kept his laser plan secret for months. No one knows about his idea or his notebook. Townes and Shallow have now solved the problem, and they're about to file for a patent. But Gould doesn't know it.
Wait a second. Why hadn't Gould already filed a patent if he came up with it first?
So this is where Gould's role as an outsider and his ignorance about the patent system come to haunt him. Remember the contact lens?
He didn't know how to apply for a patent, and also Gould was very suspicious.
If I had been smart or knowledgeable about the way the patent office works, I could have written a patent application in December of 57 on what I had down in my notebook then and gotten a patent. And all of this whole thing would have been, it never would have happened.
He didn't know that the idea was enough to get a patent. And
that proved significant.
It absolutely proved significant. Actually, it proved significant in two ways. One, it meant that Gould didn't get an early patent on the laser. And number two, the fact that he couldn't get an early patent on the laser ultimately made him rich.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves here. Before any of that happens, Gould is desperate to build a laser, and he's decided he just can't do it at Columbia.
So he leaves shy of his PhD. His dissertation is taking too much time, and he can't focus on the laser. And he also wants to escape the shadow of Charles Townes.
All the time, the idea of this laser was burning a hole in my head. And I just thought I have to get out of here and get someplace where I can work on that.
So Gould goes to work for a company called the Technology Research Group, TRG. The entire reason he's there is because they have the resources to make his laser. But once again, he's so nervous, he can't bring himself to talk about it.
But eventually he does. And TRG is so excited that it applies for a patent and a government contract to build the laser. They get $1 million, which is three times what they ask for.
They hadn't seen a proposal for a laser, so it hit him out of the clear blue sky that such a thing is actually possible.
But Townes and Shallow are working at the exact same thing, and they apply for a patent first. Then in August 1958, they write a paper in a widely read journal called Physical Review. This paper sets the rest of the physics world on a race to build the first working laser. It also means that it appears to the world that Townes and Shallow have come up with it first.
Meanwhile, the TRG contract for Gould's laser came with a classified label, which meant that Gould can't work on it. Remember those Marxist meetings? Here's where they come back to haunt Gould. McCarthyism made life oppressive for many scientists during the 1950s.
Gould was a thoroughly patriotic citizen by then. He had left the Communist Party way behind. And as an intuitive scientist, somebody who worked more effectively in the laboratory than on a piece of paper, it was really the kiss of death that he couldn't get into the laboratory to actually do his own experiments.
Gould is devastated. It's not just that he can't work on the laser. His colleagues can't even talk to him about it.
TRG does eventually build a laser, but only after someone else does, and Gould is convinced it's because he was banned from the project.
Meanwhile, in 1960, Townes and his brother-in-law, Shallow, are granted their laser patent. They call it the optical maser. Gould finds this out from the New York Times. The rug is completely swept out from under him. This patent, their patent, becomes the laser patent for the next 17 years. That's the length of time a patent can accrue royalties.
Less than 2 months later, in May 1960, Theodore Maiman, a scientist at Hughes Research Lab in California, builds the first working laser.
It was so small that when the news broke, and it made front page news all around the country, Hughes Labs made pictures of something that was larger, that wouldn't actually work, but the actual first laser was so small that it looked too insignificant to put on the front pages of the newspapers.
Wow. Rigo, so this is the end of our story?
No, it's actually just the start of the next complicated chapter. In 1962, Gould and TRG challenged Townes and Shallow's optical maser patent, using Gould's notebook as proof that it was his idea first. By the way, they call it optical maser because of the optical pumping that Gould and Townes had talked about.
All along, Gould has considered Townes to be his rival. But Townes never saw Gould that way. And when he finds out that Gould has challenged his optical maser patent, he's really confused. And then he assumes Gould stole his idea.
I just think that Townes was unable to accept that Gould had the intuitions that he had and could have done what he did. He thought that this upstart graduate student was taking his ideas and trying to make them work.
It all goes back to those conversations at Columbia. This is Charles Townes from an oral history conducted by the American Institute of Physics.
His actual notebook record and notarization was about 3 weeks after my second contact with him. What I don't know is whether he was or wasn't thinking about it before. Mm-hmm. I don't know what his ideas were before he talked with me. So I can't say to what extent he had any independent ideas.
Before he found out about the notarized notebook, Townes thought Gould had just taken his and Shallow's idea from their physical review article and not given them credit.
He didn't realize that Gould had had independent thoughts. And so this was the beginning of a scientific rivalry that ultimately played out over 30 years in Gould's attempts to win credit and recognition and ultimately money for his laser inventions. The patent system proved to me to be more complex and more frustrating and vexing, certainly than physics, which has mathematical rules.
Gould's patent challenge begins to hit some legal roadblocks. By this point, there's already a budding laser industry and other patents filed by other scientists. The whole ordeal is starting to take a lot of money and time.
It's also starting to make waves in the media. Business Week dubs it the candy store patent case. A trade journal called Product Engineering writes that the case, quote, touches on every raw nerve in science and technology. Patent ownership, federal security, academic industrial conflict of interest, research funding, and the rewards of fame and perhaps fortune.
In his testimonies, Townes portrays Gould as a slacker. Lawyers fighting Gould and TRG ask, why did he leave Columbia when he almost had a PhD? They pick apart Gould's notebook, claiming there isn't enough detail to make an actual laser.
While Gould is losing in court, Townes is being rewarded. In 1964, he shares the Nobel Prize with two other Russian physicists for his work on masers and lasers.
So the 60s pass, and the laser industry grows rapidly. A few lasers have already been built, TRG can't keep up with the legal fees, and they sell Gould back his patent rights.
But Gould doesn't give up, and he sells the right to 80% of his future royalties to finance his fight. He basically finds people to invest in his lawsuit, just like a venture capitalist would invest in a startup.
Ultimately, people who invested in Gould's patent fights were making a calculated gamble. They were saying, okay, this is a big invention. Okay, we're convinced, the lawyer tells us, that it's quite credible that Gould did invent the laser and can prove that he deserves certain laser patents. And so we're going to invest in this because the royalty stream is going to pay us back for our for our risk here. And that's what happened.
In 1977, they get their first big break.
The U.S. Patent Office finally decided who invented the laser, or one type of laser, and the inventor is about to get a patent, which means, to him,
this
money.
NBC News segment aired 20 years after Gould's notebook got notarized.
It was that notebook that finally convinced the Patent Office, after years of arguments, that Gould was the first to get the idea.
Are you going to become wealthy because of this?
It looks like I am. I never imagined it would actually happen.
Then in 1979, Gould and his team get another breakthrough. He gets another patent. So now he has two powerful patents that apply to 80% of the industry.
At this point, the laser industry freaks out. They've already been paying royalties to Charles Townes and Bell Labs, the company he and Shallow got their patent with, as well as other scientists. The laser industry is now worth more than $1 billion, and Gould stands to get 3% of all of that with his newly won patents.
The final decision comes in 1985, when the judge dismisses reexamination cases of Gould's patent. After 28 years, Gould has won. Even though he only had 20% of the rights to his patents, he walks away with a cool $46 million.
So he won. He was vindicated after all those years. That was basically it. This was actually, you know what? This was a really interesting story.
Well,
what do you mean, well?
Well, he got rich, so that was cool. But he never quite got the recognition he was looking for. And when he died in 2005, much of the press was hesitant to call him the inventor of the laser. The New York Times said that he was, quote, figure in the invention of the laser, and the Washington Post went with laser pioneer.
So people still didn't know who to believe?
Or maybe it's just that it's not that easy to explain. Joan Bromberg was a historian of science at Johns Hopkins who died in 2015. She wrote a book about lasers and interviewed Gould for those American Institute of Physics oral histories. She said that inventions, they're complicated. There's a general consensus among historians of science that it's just too simplistic to try and link an invention or a scientific discovery to one single person or to one single moment in time.
Bromberg broke down how both Gould and Townes contributed to the invention of the laser, and it all boils down to this. Neither Gould, nor Townes, nor Shallow, nor Theodore Maiman made a laser on their own. The laser came to be because all of their contributions, and other scientists as well.
Right. This is how science actually works.
Exactly. Surprise, you think this is going to be a story about a lone inventor who didn't get his due, but big inventions don't usually work like that. They take a lot of people thinking about things for a lot of time, building off of one another's ideas. It makes answering who came up with that idea first kind of hard.
Still, Nick Taylor says that Gould should be remembered in the same vein as Thomas Edison.
There's no doubt that he deserves a place in the pantheon of laser inventors and in the pantheon of inventors generally. I think that he deserves to be mentioned, if not in the same breath, then certainly in the same paragraph with his idol, Thomas Edison.
As for the patent system, well, in 2013, the United States changed its system from first to invent to first to file, in part to prevent decades-long retroactive cases like Gordon Gould's. The U.S. was the last industrialized nation to change this system, and theoretically, it's better for everyone. Well, as long as you know how the patent system works. Distillations is more than a podcast. We're also a multimedia magazine.
You can find our videos, our blog, and our print stories at distillations.org.
And you can also follow the Science History Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This episode was produced by Mariel Carr and Rigo Hernandez, with a lot of extra reporting by Rigo Hernandez.
It was mixed by Catherine Girardo.
And our theme music was composed by Zach Young.
Special thanks to Nick Taylor for sharing so much of his knowledge with us and for answering a lot of follow-up questions.
And to the American Institute of Physics for providing the oral histories of Gordon Gould and Charles Townes, especially to Amanda Nelson of the Niels Bohr Library and Archives.
We open the episode with an amazing 1962 video about the making of the laser. If you want to watch it, you can find it at archive.org. It's called, quote, The Conquest of Light.
For Distillations, I'm Lisa Berry-Drago.
And I'm Alexis Petrick.
Thanks for listening.